Welcome to the NCO Journal's Sergeant's Time podcast, a new series featuring informal conversations with leaders at all levels, where you'll have the unique chance to learn what makes them tick, what their leadership styles are, and what inspires them. Today, we welcome Command Sergeant Major Alex Caprotti. Sergeant Major Caprotti joined the Army in 1996 as an infantryman. After finishing initial entry training, he attended Airborne and Ranger School. His first duty assignment was with the 1st Battalion, 75th Ranger Regiment, at Hunter Army Airfield, Georgia, where he served as a rifleman, fire team leader, squad leader, and platoon sergeant. Caprotti deployed multiple times in his career in support of Operations Enduring Freedom, Iraqi Freedom, and Freedom Sentinel. He currently serves as a command sergeant major for the 4th Infantry Division in Fort Carson. It's an honor to have you on the show today, Sergeant Major. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. This is it's a great experience, great opportunity, so I appreciate it.
We like to start off the beginning of our Sergeant's Time podcast kind of getting to know you a little bit, because the wider Army population may not know a lot about your past and where you came from. So let's talk a little bit about where you grew up and what life was like.
So I'm born in Lima, Peru. I was raised by my grandparents. My dad and my mother moved to the States when I was almost 2 years old. Obviously, like any other immigrant story, looking for a better life. So I was raised with my grandparents for about 10 years till I was roughly 12. And that's when they were able to bring me to the States. And, you know, we resided in Hackensack, New Jersey at the time. Eventually, we moved to Alexandria, Virginia, where I called home. And I joined the JROTC program. And really, that was to be the beginning of my interest and what sparked my career in the United States Army. Used to be a school called T.C. Williams, as I think it's now Alexandria City High School. That's where I first met my first mentor, First Sergeant Smith, retired Smith from the 82nd Airborne Division. I remember the first time I saw him come into the classroom. You know, I saw his Ranger tab, his CIB, Master Raider wings, Pathfinder wings, and I was like, man, that gentleman looks sharp, you know, and the way he talked about the service and the warrior ethos and his experiences really kind of cemented for me. I think I want to be a military man. And, you know, the United States has given so much to me and my family. And I was like, what better way to give back? I'm going to be an American soldier. So, you know, I finished my high school time and I was actually admitted into Virginia Military Institute at the time. And at the time, I thought I wanted to be an officer. So I went to VMI in Lexington, Virginia. I finished my first year and really looking at military science. Some of my advisors were long tabbers. We had a ranger there that always talked about their service. And I was like, I think that's probably the route that kind of fits more with what I want to do. So I left college after my first year and joined the Army on an Option 40 contract, because I knew a new Ranger regiment was what I wanted to do. I had heard the different stories, their mission, and what they're in charge to do. And so I left, joined the service, finished AIT, went straight to Airborne School, and then on to what was back then known as RIP, the Ranger Indoctrination Program. It's a 30-day survival course that assesses you into the regiment. And that's when I was assigned, after 30 days, I was assigned to my first duty station, which is in Hunter Army Airfield, Georgia. I was the 1st Ranger Battalion. That was, I'd say, November 1996.
So it sounded like you had a lot of influence from leaders that all wore a Ranger tab. It kind of pushed you to kind of enlist and take that path.
Absolutely. It's, you know, my grandfather, you know, going back to how I was raised, my grandfather was a medic in the Peruvian police department. So I always got to see him in uniform as well. But he never, you know, he was never in the armed forces, but he was very proud of his time as a medic. I don't know if I would call him a combat medic, just a medic in the police force. But yeah, I think in high school, that was the first time where I actually was like, hey, what is that black and gold tab? What does that mean? What do they do? And I started reading about it, and obviously that kind of sparked my interest.
That's what drew you to JROTC?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's the regimented lifestyle, I guess. It's always been part of me. You know, I like what they stood for. I was always impressed by how crisp and clean their uniforms were, how they represented the organization, really, the high school at the time, and different competitions, whether it was the Raider Challenge which is known as, for high school students, drill team competitions and marksmanship competitions. I was just naturally gravitated towards that, even at that early age.
At that early age, too, we heard from a secret squirrel that you're very competitive. So were you very competitive even back then? One of the reasons maybe you joined the JROTC?
I was. And again, back to the coaching and mentoring for Sergeant Smith and my instructors, the instructors of VMI, I've been a big believer that competition breeds excellence, builds resilience in formations, individuals. So I always push myself, to try to be the best and to set an example if in any way, shape, or form, particularly if I was put in a position, that was responsible for soldiers. I wanted them to see that I would always do my best and strive to be the best.
Sergeant Major, after you enlisted, while you were a junior soldier, was there an NCO that you really looked up to, admired, and respected, kind of influenced you?
Yes, there were several. I guess I would begin with my squad leader and then my platoon sergeant, Staff Sergeant Adams, and Sergeant First Class Harlan. They were the first ones that I met. And I tell you, it was very different coming back, coming in 96. Your squad leaders were much older than the squad leaders we have now. They were in their 30s. Your platoon sergeants were late 40s. Most of these guys, walked around with combat scrolls. So a lot of experience, operational experience to bring to the table. And they did a good job at coaching and mentoring me in my early years. And then you fast forward, to the remainder of my career, and I couldn't pick a better mentor than now retired Sergeant Major Craig Bishop. I first met him in 175 Charlie Company, and really from an E5, young E6, he's been my mentor all the way until really now. I still have conversations with him, and he retired a year ago. I think he culminated his career as a JSOC Command Sergeant Major. He's been very influential. And the choices I've made in my career, the approach I took through leadership, and how I've changed over time.
Do you have any stories, like anything that stands out in your memory about something that happened with these two individuals that really stays in your mind, that really influenced who you became, who you are as a leader now?
Oh, absolutely. The Army is an effects-based organization, and we typically want to get to the finish line quickly and as efficiently as possible. And as a leader, we're expected to be problem solvers. Ideally, we're expected to be problem preventers. So when a problem comes, your typical response is to say, do X, Y, and Z, and then move on to the next point. What was common across these leaders is they forced me to think through every problem set I presented to them. And they were really the first ones that did that. Again, everybody's like, hey, do this. Okay, roger that, Sergeant, move out. But they were like, hey, well, good product. Let's look at this. What is it that you want to do? What do you think the true problem is? So they actually forced me to think of innovative ways and techniques to arrive. And they would tell me, did you come to me so I can solve your problem? Because I'm not the person for that. And they single-handedly allow me. I carry that throughout my career. When I have problems that arise, I'm like, hey, well, what do you want to do? What can you do before you come and ask me? And then, kind of help leaders work through those problem sets and let them and empower them to come with a solution. So that was single-handedly one of the biggest things that I learned from the three of them.
You mentioned back when you had your mentors, staff sergeants, they were about 30 years old. Platoon sergeants were about 40. That's not the case nowadays, right? We have younger NCOs. So maybe can you talk about what that places, what kind of a burden that places on those young NCOs, and maybe some advice that you can give them?
Absolutely. I tell you, it's hard being a soldier. It's even harder to be a leader. And every time I talk to formations, I remind them of that. I remind them of the sacrifices that they've made in the service, reminder of the sacrifices they're yet to make, and that's them and their families. But, going back to 96 and the age of our team leaders and squad leaders, but most importantly, what were they entrusted to do? So it's very first, I guess, is the first thing I want to do is delineate the difference between, the special operations community. So the Ranger Regiment belongs to USASOC. And the particular mission set is different. They are the most elite infantry unit in the Army. But they also benefit from many things, you know, and that's due to the mission they're entrusted to do. You know, shooting, moving, communicating, that was the life for us. We trained day and night. And if you're familiar with the Ranger Regiment, you know, they have four different charters. One of the charters, and you know, says that the Ranger Regiment will send its forces out to the conventional force, and then share some of the TTPs, SOPs, and Ranger doctrine to make the formation better. And it wasn't really till I left in 2017 to be part of 3rd Squadron, 4th Cavalry Regiment that I actually was able to see some of the challenges that existed, but some of the incredible opportunities as well. So fast forward now, and as I look at my time as a team leader and what I was expected to do and what we expect to a young corporal or E5 to do is significantly different. You know, let's start first with technology. Technology is so far more advanced than it was back then. You know, I might date myself, and maybe you guys know 126 radio. When I got that ready as a team leader, I thought I was the most awesome leader in the world. And now we have radios, 163s, that, you know, utilize TSM waveform, mesh networks. So technologies far outpace where I was when I was a team leader. And this young NCOs are expected to learn those. There are significant challenges in the service now. So we expect soldiers to understand organizations that can help facilitate issues, you know, family issues, professional and personal. Those are things that as I look back, I didn't have to worry. So the importance of developing, you know, our junior leaders now and preparing them to face some of those challenges is crucial. And, you know, it's something that, you know, transcends the institutional knowledge that they get through PME is, you know, how much time as a squad leader, platoon sergeant, or senior NCO do you spend to fill those gaps so you can make them successful and be able to provide what they need, what their soldiers need in their families.
A lot of, we've had conversations here in this podcast where a lot of our NCOs are thrust into leadership positions before they're ready. And a lot of those things can be avoided if they did certain things. You know, we've gotten some advice from NCOs, reading, getting knowledgeable, doctrine, getting stories from those that have served, that have been there. Have helped, you know, mentorship, those kinds of things. And I know that you're passionate about imparting that knowledge down to the junior NCOs. What advice would you give them?
Okay. Yes. So obviously we all know the predicament we find ourselves in with the sessions right now. That's caused a lot of our junior leaders to fleet up. As a perfect example, you know, we have Sergeant First Classes filling positions of first sergeants. We have master sergeants filling positions of operations sergeant majors. And then it goes down the ladder. You have specialists filling as team leaders. So, you know, what I've always looked at and asked the leaders as, you know, as we sit around a table is, what are, back to the gaps, what is NCOAS? You know, what are we missing? Some of these soldiers have never been to the academy, yet, you know, we expect them to fill the role of a sergeant major, you know, something that they pick up over their tenure in the academy. So we're looking at ways to fill the gap through those team leader, squad leader, first sergeant courses and use the shared operational knowledge that exists inside the formation to set them up for success. You know, we talk about coaching, developing, and I think we get wrapped up around making everything so formal nowadays that we miss the opportunities that happen on a daily basis, whether it's you're walking through the motor pool or you're going to watch a platoon company live fire and you just sit next to a group of leaders or a group of soldiers and just talk through, you know, what you have seen and, you know, how you can tie it to an experience that you've had. And again, you know, make them think through what just happened, what was supposed to happen, and then impart some of the knowledge. That's another thing that as leaders, we don't rely on that method very much, and we think everything has to happen in this perfect scenario where we have a PowerPoint slide when the opportunities are there every day. You just have to take advantage of them.
Yeah, I know that there's also a change coming too with the move away from COIN to large-scale combat operations and multi-domain operations. So I think some of the stories that maybe the older guys are imparting or telling the younger guys may or may not. I mean, some things transcend whatever battlefield. You know, it's going to be the same regardless. But some of these changes are happening, you know, in doctrine and training. I don't know. Let's talk about that. Is there anything you could say on that subject, Sarmid?
That's a great question, and really one of the main reasons we've come here to Leavenworth this week is talk about that shift from COIN to large scale combat, multi-domain operations, the combined employment of, you know, army and joint capabilities really to defeat the enemy. In a nutshell, really, what does that mean? And I would say going back to COIN, I deployed 16 times over the course of the last two decades. And really, that was the fight, team, squad, platoon level fights, right? And now you make that shift into large scale combat when you're looking at division corps, field armies getting after it. So there's some changes that have to take place. But we need to understand first and most foremost and educate the force as to what are those changes. And I try to keep it simple so I can communicate down to the lowest level to a team and say, hey, you know, the fight in Afghanistan and Iraq, you know, we had a very mature environment and we benefited from the mature environment. I talk about how easy sustainment was, how easy maintenance was. You can always rely on a ring route to get to your FOB and provide the things that you needed. Generally permissive, you still fought every day. For pieces of land that you can exploit or intelligence you need to exploit, and largely uncontested. Now, as we move to Lesko, you have, you know, the pacing threat, which is China, and acute threat, which is Russia. They have capabilities that just we simply have, and some of which that we don't know about. We've seen them use some of it, you know, in the conflict with Ukraine. So we're facing, or we will be facing, a peer threat. And what does that mean for us as NCOs is more important than not is focusing on the basics. And everybody uses that, being brilliant at the basics, being good at the small things. But what exactly does that mean? And I'll tell you, my approach is, I try to give them examples. Let's talk about land navigation. The enemy's ability to use, cyber EW, to deny your ability to use GPS, to deny your ability to communicate basic tactical networks. So, being brilliant at navigating and communicating the way you used to back in the day before all this embedders and radios came out is critical. The sustainment and maintenance, so how do you plan that? How does that fit into your CONOP, right? If you run out of ammunition, you're just simply going to call a helicopter. He's going to come in and gently put your extra ammo into there, your maintenance. We've taken shortcuts, and I think we've benefited a lot during COIN from a lot of things, contract work. If we're in a FOB and we're overcome and we have to go on a mission, hey, we got contractors. So understanding the basics, 5988s, how to do proper PNCS, taking care of your equipment, taking care of your stuff that's going to assist you in being lethal on the battlefield. It's going to be very critical as we switch into large-scale combat.
Sarmid, I want to ask about a topic that kind of falls in line with that. It's very significant to our soldiers and our families. The Army recently released a new Army structure, or RSTRUC, changes to modernize and transform the Army. To kind of mitigate that rumor mill among our troops across the Army, can you tell us a little bit about what that is and what that means?
Yeah, no, I'm glad you asked that. This question was just asked as well a little while ago. So you answered part of it. You know, it's we're looking to modernize the Army and really transform the Army. So what does the Army look in 2030, 2035, 2040? And what are we doing to keep up the tempo that our adversaries are doing? Really, what we're focusing with our soldiers and their families, because we know it's a stressor for them. They don't know what their future is. And first and foremost, what we tell them is nobody's getting laid off. You're going to have a job. But as the Army looks back to the COIN and transforming and moving into large-scale combat, we need to modernize to keep up with what the Department of Defense expects the Army to do. And that is the creation of different units, MDTFs, long-range precision fires. And that comes at a cost, right? So the Army has identified 12 distinct MOSs that require that level of expertise. And they've delineated the MOSs where the strengths need to come down. And some of those MOSs will be will have the opportunity to either reclassified into the 12 MOSs we discussed. You know, there's a finite time, and the People Conference a couple of weeks ago kind of delineated that, hey, you know, it's be different phases. For us, particularly in the 4th Infantry Division, 20 August is the date that we've placed to really divest or close down the CAP squadrons. So all the analysis is going into that right now, identifying the skill level per MOS that we need to approach. And it's a holistic approach. The career counselors play a good part of it. Our G1, you know, managing our strengths and understanding what the Army wants us to do. What are we going to be able to retain inside the formation? Because not all of these MOSs will move. Some of these will be just shifted within the division. Some will be asked to reclassify, and some of them will be asked to move to augment other formations who still require that MOS.
The NCO is going to play a big role in communicating this down to soldiers. So, Sergeant Major, right now you have the ears of a lot of NCOs out there. What advice would you give them as they're communicating this to their soldiers?
Well, first and foremost is be patient and be cognizant that our junior soldiers and their families are going to be stressed, especially some of these MOSs that potentially just moved into the area. They're worried that we're going to be asked to move right now. We don't have any predictability, and that's not ideal. So first and foremost is, you know, try to get them to stick to the points. Is soldiers want to know why. I mean, I think informed soldiers are more productive soldiers. So I always talk about explain the why. Why is the Army doing this? Right? If you've been in the Army long enough, you know that this has happened in the past. You know, this 4th Brigade is close, and it was an emotional moment back then. But we were able to work through that. But really arming them with the facts. And right now, we're actually still waiting for a MILPER message that will get into the micro details of how some of this. But I think what we've kind of spelled out here for the leadership really explains the reason, and will give them like the options that they have. And you know, it's the Army's doing a good job at incentivizing some of these moves. Not all of those moves, will have an SRB attached to them. But again, we're waiting for that MILPER message to kind of give us a little more detail, because I know soldiers will have more and more questions.
I know that this ties into that. There's probably some maturities, but is there like a rough timeline? I think that would be important. That would be something that the NCOs would like to share with their troops.
Yeah, so I'll be speculating on the timeline right now. So we know we have an E-date for our cavalry squadron, 20 August, and that's particular to the CAF, obviously. But what I do know is there's three different phases in which the Army will approach this problem set. And then the first one is going to be a soldier's choice. You know, a soldier will have a choice to reclassify to one of the 12 MOSs that the Army needs. Then the second one will go into a limited choice, obviously, as those positions start to get filled. And then the last one will be a DA-directed choice. Hey, these are the ones that are available right now, and this are the positions and the locations. But as far as a definitive timeline, I do not have that right now.
How about we go back a little bit to leadership? What was the biggest challenge you ever faced, and what did you do to overcome it?
Oh wow, that's there are many challenges. It's moving from team leader to squad leader. You know, moving through the ranks is a challenge in its own. I would tell you the biggest challenge I had would most likely be as I was moving from platoon sergeant into first sergeant, what I would equate to being the first level organizational leadership. And the reason why I had spent over a decade really what we call in the knife fight, you know, am I doing things right? Is my formation doing right? Are we entering clearing this room the right way? Are we clearing this trench? And now is a sudden shift of thinking, you know, up a little bit more and trying to understand your commander's intent at the, you know, at the battalion brigade level, was what took me a little bit long to grasp. Are we doing the right things? Is the best way to put it. And that involves, you know, one, understanding commander's intent. How is your training nested into the bigger picture? I would say that's where I struggled the most. A little bit mature quite a bit, but I was fortunate to have, you know, good leaders, my company commander, my battalion CSM, to kind of walk me through that and help me understand. As a team leader, blunt force trauma and repetition is, you know, what I grew up on. And not saying that I condone that, other than the repetition. I'm a believer of repetition, equals or ends up in perfection. I would tell you, if I can tell you a story of one of my failures. I think I had just become a squad leader. It was probably our second deployment to Afghanistan, and you know, we're coming back from a routine operation, and the same thing, gun trucks pull into the FOB, lock and clear, move through, and then right into our area where we are, our motor pool. And every single time we did this, it was like clockwork. It had become routine, except on this one day I broke routine and I failed to inspect. And I always talk to my leaders. I was like, you have to inspect every single time. That is your job as a leader. Inspections before, during, after. And I did not inspect that day. And what this resulted in an accidental discharge of a large caliber machine gun inside of the FOB. And very fortunate for us is nobody was injured. There was no significant damage to any structure. But I was called to the table at the time, and I told my commander, I was like, take full responsibility. I felt to do what I asked my soldiers to do, and that's, inspect, trust but verify. And that is your job as a leader. And I got caught up in routine, and I failed to do my basic duty. And it resulted in a letter of reprimand. I learned from that. From that mistake, I owned the mistake, and I was able to speak to the formation regarding that, and I said, "This is what happened," and impervious incidents will happen, and you have to put yourself between the what we always say is the point of friction, and that carried me for a while because it could have been catastrophic. But that is one of the biggest events that I remember, and it happened during deployment. That stays with me, and I usually use as to the importance of, locking and clearing your weapons or ensuring, you've done your safety checks in and out of the range. Does that answer kind of what you were asking?
Oh yeah, those kind of situations are the your failures are what builds character. Without challenges, you're just kind of muddling your way through life. But I think I've failed plenty of times in my life, and I think with every one of those failures, there was a lesson learned and an opportunity for growth. And I think that's important for young NCOs to know that failing once just means you get back up, dust yourself off, go for it again. Failure is not an option. Victory and success and doing the best you can it's a great example, Sergeant Major, and I really appreciate you bringing that up.
So that's great, actually, what you just said. Failure is not an option. You got to fail, get up, and dust yourself off, which is great. But leaders own a big part of that, right? And back to my mentors, and this is what I've tried to kind of exemplify, is somebody can fail, and you can tell them they fail without making them feel like a failure, and that is single-handedly one of the most important things. Is creating an environment where it's okay to fail. It's hard. Back to a products-based organization, you want to do things fast, quickly, and move on to the next problem set. So you have to have patience, and that brings into the discussion, what culture, what kind of culture are you building on as a leader? And we talk about psychological safety. How do you build that inside your formation? And it may sound like a technical term, but it's really you creating an environment where your soldiers come, thrive, feel good and feel okay with providing feedback, and most importantly, feel okay with failing. You as a leader manage that. Now, you know, as a leader, you need to understand, you know, train your units in accordance with their capabilities. And that's a conversation we have with senior leaders too. It's like, I'm saying it's okay to fail. You kind of control that in a way, though. You establish just left and right limits. Am I going to put an E3 in charge of creating a CONOP for a squad, a platoon attack or a company attack? Probably not. He's going to struggle through it. So knowing your people plays a particular part, but creating the environment for them to thrive is significant and will go a long ways building the trust in your formation.
Yeah, some of the best leaders I had didn't let failures identify the individual. And I think that's what really helped. You know, I had leaders that didn't tolerate failure, but they didn't let failure define who that person was or their character. And I always felt that that's what allowed that growth, right? To know, yeah, I failed, but this doesn't mean that I'm a failure. It just means I need to be better at this and then growing.
Absolutely. I agree. And I tell you, as growing, you know, it's tied to you as a leader creating a plan of action to improve your formation. You know, what does that look like? And back to the growing and the culture that you're creating, you know, those feedback mechanisms you have with soldiers can come to you to you know, request either feedback or provide feedback on how you're doing things as a leader. That's something that even as a young E5, I was not comfortable with doing. I always saw it as a, you know, I'm letting myself be vulnerable. But, you know, one of the pieces of advice I can tell a team leader is, like, it's okay with leading and vulnerability, you know, showing your soldiers you're a human being at the end of the day, and asking for feedback on how you're doing things and how you're managing your formations is not a sign of weakness. It's just a sign that you want to be better, and you know you're not blind. You understand you have blind spots. You may not know what they all are, and that took me to become almost like, you know, I would say squad leader, platoon sergeant before I started having those conversations. I'm like, hey, how is the platoon going? What are we doing good? What are we not doing so good? What can I improve on? What am I not resourcing you with to be successful? So if you become comfortable doing that, you know, as a young team leader, I think it will go a long ways in your personal development.
You know, one of the things about all this conversation, though, is that when it comes to failing or practicing those leadership skills and attributes, and is that now is the time to fail. Now is the time to practice and to learn, because when it comes time to go to the field, to go into combat, you know, failure and not being able, not getting it right, could mean the difference between life and death. So this is the place. Now is the time to make those mistakes, to grow from them, so that when the time comes, you know, you'll have figured most of it figured out. You can never figure it all out, because you'll never know what happens in combat. But you know, that's just one of the things I think that we should focus on.
It's, yeah, no, absolutely. So going back to 1996, November, you know, I told you about looking at my team leaders, squad leaders, or the combat scrolls. You know, we all came in the Army to get after it and go to combat and test ourselves and prove that we're better. And we went year after year after year training. And I remember now when I talked to soldiers, they're like, you know, the up tempo is a little high, you know, we're training all the time. And I can think back, you know, 27 years, I was saying the exact same thing. I just wanted to go to combat. But I tell you what, what I tell them now is, you know, you never fix a roof when it's raining. You fix it when it's sunny. And I said, it's sunny right now. There is some volatility worldwide. Anything can happen at any given time, you know. But when the red star cluster goes up, you have to be ready. And when unfortunately those planes crash into the towers, you know, we were in a plane flying across the ocean to take the fight to the enemy. And I always tell them, so what do you want to be? You know, you want to be ready, right? Because at that time, there's you have no time. I wish I would have done this. I wish I would have done this different. You go with what you have. You go with the equipment and men and women in your formation. And hope that your training pays off. It's a great point. It's now is the time to train. Now it's the time to, you know, experience some of those failures and learn from those failures.
So, Sergeant Major, what is, in your opinion, the most important things that NCOs should focus on now and why?
Okay. Three things. I would tell you, focus on the culture you're building in the organization. And everybody thinks that that's, you know, senior leader business. And I tell you that that starts as a team leader. Again, building the environment to learn and be able to save, to feel safe at failing. You own that at a very early level. Trust. You have to develop trust, and that takes patience. That takes time. You have to be constantly engaging with your formation and know your formation. You have to come off as genuine. Your soldiers know when you're not genuine. Your soldiers know when you're doing it because you're in front of a leader or because that is part of the closeout tasks. Is knowing what they do every day, knowing about their families, knowing about what affects them, what troubles them, because that all carries over to your job. And trust is one of the things that takes, you know, significant a lot of time to build. I would say the last one is be inclusive. The greatest ideas that I've seen come to light in a few years has been from younger soldiers, right? They're the ones that are in the mix. They're in the fight. I'm a division sergeant major right now, you know, no longer in the trench lines as much as I want to be in the trench lines. You know, those are the people that are going to come and find the solutions to tactical problems that make sense to them. And we tend to think as senior NCOs that we have all the answers, but really when those come down the pipe and they get down to the bottom, like, hey, that doesn't make sense. And how about we try this? So really being inclusive. And again, going back to receiving that feedback. What greater way to build trust and build a climate and culture that people want to be part of than to do those three things?
I'm curious, Sergeant Major, as a squad leader, platoon sergeant, or first sergeant, what type of unique thing did you bring to the organization to build that trust and get that unit together to grow?
So one of the main things I talk about inspiring people. And there's so many ways to do that. And I tell you, as you go through the ranks, you'll hear some people say, hey, you need to start pulling yourself away and looking at different things. And I would tell you, you can do all those things still and then be part of your formation. It's how much time you're willing to put and to getting to know your people, inspire them to do better things. And that's through setting the example. As a leader, there's one thing saying, I want to do this. I expect you to do that. I want you to be an expert. I want you to score, you know, 600 any ICFT. And there's another thing going out there and being part of the suffering with your formation and showing that you're willing to do it. I remember having leaders in my formation saying, we're going to go and walk 30 miles as part of our training. And they were right there next to me walking. I'm carrying a gun or I'm carrying, it's a 320 at the time. And I would see my platoon sergeant, my first sergeant, and I was like, and he's walking the walk. He's doing exactly what he asked us to do. So inspiring people to do to their best is arguably the number one thing I did kind of growing up.
One of the things we heard that you're putting into practice as well, now that you're a division sergeant major, is your Solutions Summit. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, that's right. So we kick off the Solutions Summit next week. And again, going back to getting that, you know, creating that feedback loop is how do we know that the measures we're implementing are doing anything. We're going to have E1s, 3-4s come through. I'm going to spend the day with them. The division has been iterating with different surveys and trying to understand what are the problems that exist right now. And some of them really are simple problems. They're systems and processes that we just need to solidify that it already exists. And some of them need to be brought up to the division to create. And we've done this through staff duty surveys. We've done this through numerous surveys that circulate at the brigade level. So the goal of next week is to bring a group of soldiers from the entire division, highlight some of the things that we've seen over the past 4 to 6 months. Hey, this is what you've said. Let's prioritize some of these things and then let them iterate on it, or either that or expand upon some of the things that we have yet to hear. The goal of it is to one, prioritize the things, then put manpower to some of these problems and solve them as quickly as possible. Because there's, back to the trust piece, no better way to lose the trust than just bring people together and then nothing happens. So we're hoping to do this with the Solution Summit. Next quarter, we'll attack the E5 population and I'll move up the ranks all the way out to the company level. And the CG is doing the exact same thing with his lieutenants and company commanders. And The goal is to identify the things we can fix. And what we can fix is at some point, maybe look at higher echelons of what they can do to improve quality of life or whatever other issue that is brought up.
We ask this to all of our distinguished guests for the final question. What advice would present day you give to newly promoted Sergeant Caprotti back in the day?
Oh God, you should have asked that earlier. I could go an hour, another hour talking about advice. Be patient, enjoy your job. Be patient and enjoy your job. It's the greatest honor to be an American soldier. It's even a bigger honor to have soldiers fallen under you. It's awesome. It's an incredible experience, a lot of responsibility, but really be patient and be willing to take the time to know your formation in and out. It's not just about the professional growth. There's a lot of personal that goes into that. Had I learned that at an earlier age, I think I'd have been a lot more successful than I am today.
Stay tuned for more interesting guests and inspiring conversations right here at the NC Journal. Submit your articles, get published. Don't forget to visit our webpage and follow us on social media. We'll see you next time on the Sergeant's Time Podcast.